Okay, so welcome, everybody. As usual, we're going to say the refuge and bodhicitta prayer. Just to remind you, we are studying the refuge chapter, so invite you to participate fully in the meaning of what we're going to do here. So, Linda's not here, so we don't have a chant master. Do we have any volunteers? Sangye chotang choki choram la Changju bar du dang ni kyab su chi Dagi jing zo gi be zo nam gi Rola bing du zong gi du par jo. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Sem chen tong che de wa tong de vi yu tong den par gyur chi Dunga tong dunga gi gyu tong tra war gyur chi Dunga ri pi de wa tong mi tra war gyur chi Ye ring cha dong tong tra vi Tang non la ne par gyurchi. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. Saji bhumi chushi me dotram Rira lingji ninde ginbadi Sangye jing do mi te puwari Drokun nam da jing ajur parishu. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle of this mountain river, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon, visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure hands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Saparivar Ratna Mandala Pudza Mega Samudra Saparana Samayi. A couple of people have told me that they are getting something out of doing this reading, which is great. But I would just like to remind everybody that it's really thanks to Lama that's happening, because Lama's the one who brought this text over from India and Tibet to us and gave very extensive commentary for many months, well, a few years ago, and as well as all of the other things that Lama does for us. It's something we really shouldn't take for granted, because there's a lot of centers that don't have a resident Lama. So thank you, Lama. And I want to just acknowledge Lama for that and point that out. Okay, so any mistakes are mine, but any merit is Lama. So. Did anybody check their cup this week? How's your cups? Remember we talked about the different kinds of cups? Did anybody have any cracks that needed to be repaired in their cups? Yeah, a little. What's that Japanese art form where they do that?
Oh, the gold.
They put gold in the cracks and make a piece of art. Yeah.
Chinese just throw them in.
Wasabi or?
I don't know the word, but that's a great idea, I think. So. Okay, so let's do a communal cup repair here, do a little quick review of where we're at. So everybody's sort of up to speed. It's only been a week, but it seems like a lot happens in a week. So maybe just to review where we're at, we'll do this together. So what text are we studying?
The beautiful ornament.
The beautiful ornament of the three visions. Okay. By Norchen Kuntrung Lungdrop. And it's part of what bigger tradition?
Lamdre.
The Lamdre, yeah. And what's the English for Lamdre?
Path and its result.
The path and its result, yeah. Or the path including the result. Sometimes you see the path and the fruit, but it's the path including the result. Okay. This is a commentary of a text that was written in the 1500s. But before that, about 400 years before that, there were some commentaries written. It was a lot of words, and so Sakya Pandita, who's one of our founders of the Sakya school, he made it easy for us folks, and he simplified it down into basically two sections. And this book is a commentary on those two sections. Does anybody remember what the two sections are? Simple. The preliminaries
and the practice.
Yeah. Okay. We're in the preliminary section. And how many subsections are there? How many chapters in the preliminaries?
Two.
Two? Yeah. What was the one that we studied before?
Faith.
Faith. And now we're into?
Refuge.
Okay. So that's where we're at. Just a review for everybody. And there's sections, there's five, I think, sections here. So we talked about the cause of taking refuge, fear, faith, and compassion. And since we studied faith already, we already know about faith. So that's easy. And then the next section was the object of taking refuge.
So what page are you on?
10. So the object, is there only one way to take refuge? No. There's lots of different ways. And why? Why are there different ways?
Because there are different people.
Different people and different traditions, right? And there's different ways of doing it. So we want to, you know, give tolerance that they're all fine, it's all good. We don't have to say our way is the best, you know. So the explanation here, of course, we're not going to explain all the other different ways of doing it. We're going to explain this tradition. Does anybody remember what this way of taking refuge is called? 5 points for this answer.
Mahayana?
Mm-hmm. It is Mahayana, great vehicle, but this particular way is called fourfold. Okay, fourfold refuge. So what are the four objects?
The Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and...
Yeah, is that the order, though?
Huh? First?
What's first?
Precepts.
No, that's the right answer, but the order we want to get a little different. What's the guru?
The Buddha,
Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, that's the fourfold refuge. Okay. So those are the objects. And then, no, you're on a roll. And then the procedure, it was the next section on page 11, how to do it. So we know the cause, we know the object, and now, well, how do we do it? And so there's a rather elaborate description here of the procedure. Obviously, the prayer that we just did is a shortened version, but we're going to go through the procedure here. And last time we got partway through it, and there's a description that we went through about, you know, how you fold your hands and what you think and so on. And then we talked a little bit about if you are able to visualize what you could visualize. Remember we talked about visualization? Mm-hmm. Does anybody remember what we visualize? Or what we could visualize?
The Buddha and the assembly?
Yeah. So there's kind of an elaborate way of doing it, and there's a simple way of doing it. This tonka behind me here is a very elaborate, it's called a refuge tree. If you're really good at visualization, you can do that. But if you're not, you can also just consolidate into your guru or the Buddha, which are the same. And so there's a single image, and all of these other objects of refuge are contained in that one single image. So that makes it a little simpler for people like me that are still learning how to visualize. So if you want to do that, that's fine. But you're thinking that all of this is contained in that single image. Correct me if I'm wrong, Lomo. Okay. And I've heard His Holiness Sakyatrichin talk about this a number of times, and he's saying that that's just fine to do it that way. And I think for a beginner, it's probably not much choice. I don't know anybody that can start on that complicated image, but it's fine to do just a single image.
Could you not visualize Sakyatrichin?
Sorry?
Could you not visualize Sakyatrichin?
If he's your guru.
Because I know the Dalai Lama has said, told people that if you have trouble with that, just visualize me.
Yeah, if he's your guru, yeah. We ended up, I believe, on the top of page 12. There at the first paragraph. Oh, and also you can visualize yourself with all sentient beings, your relatives, friends, enemies, all beings, in human form. And you visualize all of them, all of us, are making prostrations as we do the visualization. And Sakyatrichin said to even visualize lots and lots of images of yourself, like millions of yourself, then you generate more merit that way, because it's all a visual, it's all a practice of the mind. I mean, Buddhism is basically mind training, right? You want to generate merit, you can multiply your images and you gain more merit. Why do we want to gain merit? Well, what is merit? Merit is positive spiritual energy, but why are we concerned about generating merit? What do we need merit for?
To generate good karma, positive karma for future lives.
Yeah. So we want to accumulate merit, this positive energy. The idea is that we want to have the accumulation of wisdom to the realization of wisdom. But in order to do that, we need merit. So it's kind of the precursor. So anything that we can do that generates positive energy towards our ultimate outcome, so to speak, is something that we want to use skillful means. It's called skillful means. So we visualize whatever we can, and if you can't visualize, that's fine too. You just, with your mind, you're doing the mental part of I'm going for refuge to the fourfold refuge with sincerity, because spacing out while you're doing it doesn't count. Shantideva has told us several times already, and he's going to repeat it, that you need to have your mind focused on what you're doing. So with mindfulness and sincerity, it says, and then we request the blessing from the refuge objects. And we're about to read several ways of doing that. So now we're going to start on the new material where we left off last time. So so I don't end up talking all evening. Somebody would like to read this where it says, please bestow your blessings. You have a volunteer?
I'll read it.
Okay.
Please bestow your blessings upon me in all my lifetimes. Bless me that my mind may become attuned to the teachings. Bless me that I may traverse the path. Bless me that errors on the path may be allayed. Bless me that illusions may appear to me as transcendental wisdom. Bless me that irreligious thoughts may not arise within my mind even for a single moment. Bless me that uncontrived love, compassion, and aspiration to enlightenment may be aroused. And bless me that I may quickly attain the state of omniscience, perfect enlightenment.
Okay, thank you. This is a request for blessing. So there's different kinds of prayers. You might have a prayer of praise. There's a prayers where you praise the Buddha or you praise the qualities of Tara or so on and so forth. So that's one kind of prayer, a praise. You might have a prayer of aspiration, you know, where I'm aspiring to whatever, enlightenment or to emulate saints or so on. That's another kind of prayer. But what would you say, how would you classify this prayer? Please bestow this, please bless me, please.
A blessing prayer?
Yeah. What's another word for that, though?
Motivation?
You have a motivation of altruism, but if we wanted to make a category, this is not praise, really. It's not aspiration.
It sounds like help. It sounds like a help me kind of like...
Yeah, if you're saying it's a supplication. Mm-hmm. Please,
like help me.
Bless me, help me. It's a supplication. So that's a kind of type of prayer that we could be... you know, labeling this as a supplication prayer. And if you notice, it kind of starts out in the beginning and it kind of gets stronger as it goes along until it ends with the state of omniscience, perfect enlightenment. So we're kind of building up the supplication as we go through the prayer. So that's kind of interesting. At the very end it says, may I quickly attain the state of omniscience. Why do you think it says quickly? Are we in a hurry?
Yep.
Why?
Because we need to be a benefit to all sentient beings.
Yeah. All of our mothers are suffering in samsara. So we don't have time to mess around. We want to get going. So we want to do it quickly. That's part of our supplication. Help me to do this quickly. I have a job to do. Remember, this is Mahayana, greater vehicle. So Bodhisattva works for the benefit of others. So... that's why it says quickly. And then in the next one, it's a different version. It's in verse form. So would somebody like to read the next one?
Okay, I'll give it a try. In the most holy preceptor, who is the essence of the qualities and deeds of the body, voice, and mind of all Tathagatas, abiding in the 10 directions and 3 times, the source of the 84,000 teachings of the doctrine and the master of all the noble assemblies. I and all sentient beings, equal to the ends of space, from this time forth until the essence of enlightenment is reached steadfastly.
Okay. So this is another way of doing it in verse form. So let's just go through and make sure we understand all the words here. So... we've talked about preceptor. Who is the preceptor here?
The guru.
The guru, yeah. Who is in the essence of the qualities and deeds of the body, voice, and mind of all the Tathagatas. Who are the Tathagatas?
The Buddhas.
The Buddhas. So this says that the preceptor is the same as the Buddhas. He's in essence, mm-hmm. is the same. Okay. Of all the Tathagatas, abiding in the 10 directions, what are the 10 directions?
North, south, east, west, northeast, northwest, north, south, northwest, southwest.
Up and down.
Okay. Okay, so a simple way of saying that, it's not a tongue twister, but it is, but it would be the 4 cardinal directions, north, south, east, west, and then the what do they call them, intermediate? Directions, north, east, south, east, the intermediate ones, and then up and down. So those are the 10 directions. In other words, everywhere. 10 directions and the 3 times. What are the 3 times?
Past, present, and future.
Past, present, and future. So, in other words, all the Buddhas. The source of 84,000 teachings. Now, we talked about this 84,000 number. Does anybody remember that discussion? What does 84,000 teachings mean? What is that?
There's a teaching for everybody?
Yeah, it's a teaching for everybody. But did somebody sit there with a counter and go 1, 2, 3? What? How did that happen? So the teachings...
aren't they the states of mind? 84,000 states of mind?
Well, the teachings, the way that Sakya Trichin explained this, and I've heard him explain this a couple of times, is that the Buddha's omniscient, and when he teaches, he teaches according to the need of the being who's getting the teaching. So one person might hear one teaching, next person hears a different teaching because their needs are different. And so there's a teaching that's appropriate for everybody, and because sentient beings are infinite, really, the teachings are infinite. But the 84,000, His Holiness explained it as, well, that's what one person heard and then eventually got written down. But it shouldn't be limited to 84,000. It's just a big number that indicates an infinite number for infinite beings. He says the Buddha has no limits and the teachings have no limit. But so when you hear 84,000, you shouldn't necessarily think, well, and then that's it. He didn't teach anymore. It's really a big number for infinite. Okay. And here it says, I and all sentient beings equal to the ends of space, meaning sentient beings are infinite. Until the essence of enlightenment is reached. So I'm going for refuge until enlightenment is reached. And that's important to remember, I think, or to know, because as we said before, there's different ways of doing refuge, and not all refuge takers go until enlightenment. Some of them go until the end of this life. But we're Mahayana, we take the vow to go until enlightenment. We go for refuge until enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So that's a particular characteristic of our way of doing refuge. So that's important to notice. And then this continues. So this is a continuation of the verse form, the second paragraph. Can somebody read that for us, please?
I'll read it.
Okay.
With great devotion of body, voice, and mind, we take refuge in the holy root and lineage preceptors. With great devotion of body, voice, and mind, we take refuge in the enlightened ones, the teachers who have reached the end of renunciation and realization. With great devotion of body, voice, and mind, we take refuge in the holy doctrine, the teaching, which is the essence of the precepts and realizations. With great devotion of body, voice, and mind, we take refuge in the noble assembly of holy beings, the bodhisattvas who uphold the teaching.
Okay, thank you. So this specifies the fourfold refuge objects, right? So what's the first one, Aaron?
The guru.
The guru. So where is that listed?
Preceptors.
Yeah, so the root and lineage preceptors. Okay, so that's the guru. And then what's next?
Enlightened ones,
that's the Buddhas. The holy doctrine, what's that?
The Dharma.
The Dharma. And how many parts to the Dharma are there?
Two.
And what are they?
Preliminary and practical. Oh, wisdom and merit?
It says it here, but it uses different words than we've used before. What does it say here?
Precepts and realization.
Yeah, so we didn't use those words before. What did we say before? Does anybody remember? We didn't say precepts. We said just hearing the teachings,
right.
Like listening. Yeah, the teachings. But is it enough to put the medicine on the shelf? No, you have to take it. And what's the second one here?
Practice.
Yeah, the practice. So the realizations come from
practice.
The practice. They don't come any other way. In other words, the Buddha cannot make us enlightened. We have to do the actual practice of Dharma. I'm sure if he could, he would, but it doesn't work that way. So we need to listen, contemplate, meditate, or practice. Okay, so it says that here, that the doctrine or the Dharma has two parts. It reminds us. And then what's the last one?
Sangha.
What does it say here, though?
Devotion.
Noble assembly.
Noble assembly.
Right.
Now, we talked about that, too. There's different kind of types of Sangha. There's the... But here it says, noble assembly of holy ones, the bodhisattvas. So we go to refuge to the bodhisattvas, the ones that are really, really, really advanced. And then there's a more common type of Sangha. We talked about that. Anybody remember that?
Is that just lay people?
It's everybody else who's not in that high level, but we look up to somebody who's more advanced or more experienced than us.
You can, like the lamas. And
somebody that's more experienced than you, you can call them the Sangha. And then the sort of common use of the word Sangha is it's just us practitioners. But here, we're not going to refuge to us. We're going for refuge or to refuge to the noble ones, the Arya, the exalted ones, the very, very, very high bodhisattvas that are objects of refuge. We're going to get there, but we're not quite there yet, at least most of us. Okay, so this is a verse form of how to actually say the refuge. And then it says, recite this as many times as one can. And we talked about that. Do you remember, why would we say it more than once?
For merit.
For merit. And why do we need merit?
Spiritual progress.
Yeah, to get the wisdom. Okay. Sometimes the refuge prayer is repeated. And when we do it here, before we start, we do it three times. That's one of the reasons we do it three times. So you can say it as many times as you can. And then we go and we have another recitation. So let's read that. Who would like to read that for us?
I'll read it. We prostrate and take refuge in the most excellent preceptor and the three jewels. Please bestow your blessings upon the body, voice, and mind of myself and all living beings. Bless us that our minds may become attuned to the Dharma. Bless us that we may traverse the path of religion. Bless us that we may be cleared of all errors. That the way may be cleared of all errors. Bless us that the illusory visions may appear as transcendental wisdom. Bless us that irreligious thoughts may never arise. Bless us to accomplish the two kinds of enlightenment and thought. Bless us quickly to attain Buddhahood.
Thank you. So, what kind of prayer would you classify this one as? Is this praise?
No. Supplication.
No. Hmm?
Supplication.
Yeah, this is another supplication. We're still supplicating, okay? So we're asking for these blessings from the preceptor and the three jewels, all these ones, these blessings that are listed here. And at the very end it says, bless us to accomplish the two kinds of enlightenment thought. Now I'll just say the names, which are relative and absolute, but because that topic will be covered later in the book, we're not going to go into it now, also because it's a big topic. So we'll just list that, and if you want, you can make a note that it's relative and absolute, and it'll be covered later in the text. And then here we have it again, quickly attain Buddhahood, this quickly idea that we want to go fast. That's one of the reasons for the Vajrayana or the diamond path, is because it's faster. And that's the topic of the other book, the three tantras. Okay. Now, just to remind you, we've been doing some kind of visualization, if we can, or something. We have these refuge objects in front of us in our visualization, or at least in our mind. We have ourselves and our all sentient beings either visualized or in our mind. And we're doing these supplication prayers as the actual process of going for refuge. At this point, the refuge tree or whatever we're visualizing dissolves and it comes into us. So the usual way is described as it through the crown chakra down into our heart, but it actually dissolves into our body. We absorb it. We create it and then we absorb it. Okay? So that's the mechanics of the process of what we're going to do when we do this refuge. And then we go on to the next paragraph. Who would like to read that?
I have a question before you.
Okay.
And you said that, like, we have this visualization and then we incorporate it into ourselves and mm-hmm. absorb it. Is that, like, inherent, or that's just the practice that everybody knows and that's why it's not
in? That's why we have commentaries, because okay. not everything is in the book. Most of these texts, to really understand it completely, you need somebody who can, okay. who knows how to add on the stuff that's not in the book.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
But isn't it that because we want to fulfill our Buddha nature, that taking the Buddha into us is part of that mind training of absorbing to further our own enhancement of our Buddha nature?
Yeah, because it's inseparable anyway. We just have this illusion that it's separate. It's actually
right.
not. So
right.
this reinforces the non-duality, I guess you could say.
Right.
Okay. Who would like to read? Okay.
For a short while, in the manner of meditating and visualizing, think further that due to one's prayer, the objects of refuge, see me through the transcendental wisdom of omniscience, heed me through the compassion of love, cherish me through the activities of transcendental deeds, protect me from the power of shielding, and bless and keep watch over me.
Okay, so this is another supplication. You know, I lived in Italy for a long time, and everybody over there, there's no Buddhists hardly at all. Certainly not where I lived. Everybody is sort of Catholic, at least by name. And they have some funny ideas of what Buddhism is and what a Buddhist is. And I used to get people who thought that Buddhism was godless existentialism. And they felt sorry for me. They said, well, you don't have anybody to help you. You're all alone. That's terrible. You know, they were really like, oh, you poor guy. Well, I tried to say, well, it's exactly like that, but and here you have the words that say that or that show that we're asking for all of the all of the benefits and blessings and protections and so on, love, compassion, activities, power that the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas do give us and are able to give us, but we need to ask for it. We need to supplicate it. It's something that it's there, but we need to open up and receive it. It's like the sun shines for everybody, but we need to clear away the clouds, you know. So it's the process of doing these prayers that is the opening up that allows the receiving of it. It's not that they're not willing to give it to everybody, it's that not everybody's open. So by saying these types of supplications, we're inviting it. We're saying, I'm ready to receive it. Please bless me. Please give me all these benefits. So I tried to explain that in Italy, but these are the words that actually explain it. Okay. Okay, so let's continue on. Who would like to read the next paragraph here?
I'm having some jaw pain today.
So. Jaw pain, you're taking a pass. Okay.
I'll read it.
Okay.
The conclusion of the procedure is to direct the merit one has earned through the taking of refuge for the enlightenment of all beings and to be mindful. When one rises from the session of meditation, reflect. In this way, by whatever merit I have accumulated, may my parents and all other beings attain the state of enlightenment that accomplishes the well-being of oneself and others. The following verse, written by the master Nagarjuna, and any other prayers of dedication one knows, may also be recited. What did he say?
Okay, so, thank you. In the beginning of this chapter, I don't know if you remember last week, there was a little introductory paragraph that explained that normally when we do just about any practice, we have three sections. We have the refuge and bodhicitta, then we have the main practice, whatever it is we're going to do, whether it's mantra recitation or sadhana or whatever it is. And then at the end we have the dedication of merit. Those are the three parts that normally construct a practice. Text here explained that in this case, because the topic or the practice, the listening practice that we're doing is refuge, we start by going for refuge, but the middle main part is also about refuge. So that's what we're studying. But then at the end, we do dedication. So in the explanation of the how do you do refuge part, which is what we're in, we have now arrived at the third step, which is the dedication of merit step. And there's a lot of explanation in Shanti Davis' text about dedication of merit, but basically, just to say it sort of simply, we've done merit-generating practice. We've done a positive spiritual practice, in this case, refuge. We don't want to just sort of leave it hanging, so to speak. And the reason is that if we commit a non-virtue, like if we're angry, it cancels out the merit that we generated. It sort of erases it, so to speak, and we've basically wasted it. And we don't want that, because we're not doing this just for ourselves, we're doing it for all sentient beings. So we want to sort of spread it around, so to speak, and save it, so to speak. It's like when you do a Word document, you know, save with name kind of thing. If you don't save it, guess what? It disappears. It's kind of like that. The dedication of merit is a sort of a seal that we put on it that not only preserves it from being destroyed by our possible negativity, but it spreads it for all beings, because that's what we're doing it for. We're doing it for all beings. We're not just doing it for ourselves, right? So that's kind of very briefly a description of what dedication of merit is about. At this point, we actually have been given the words in quotations here,
In this way,
by whatever merit I have accumulated, may my parents and all other beings attain the state of enlightenment that accomplishes the well-being of oneself and others. Quote. So that's the actual prayer or statement of dedication that you can use. It's given in quotes so that we actually have the words. We don't have to make it up or worry about how to say it. And then Master Nagarjuna, who was a great Buddhist philosopher, a giant of Buddhist history, there's a scriptural validation here from him which says, through this virtue may all beings accomplish the accumulation of merit and wisdom, and may they attain the two holy bodies which arise from wisdom and merit. Now, there's lots of different ways of talking about Buddha's bodies. He has two bodies, three bodies, four bodies. In this case, it makes reference to two holy bodies, which arise from merit and wisdom, which we've been talking about all along. This is not really a supplication prayer. What is it?
It's a dedication.
Mm-hmm. It is a dedication.
It's like an offering.
It's an aspiration, is what it is. So when you see may such and such and such happen, that's an aspiration. Now, what's an aspiration? There's different ways of talking about this, but the way I like to think about it is, it's like planting a seed. It's like planting a karmic seed that you make an aspiration. It's not just, gee, I wish, wouldn't it be nice? But I'm really making a specific conscious aspiration here, and I'm planting this seed. May all beings be enlightened, or may all beings, whatever the aspiration is. So that's another type of prayer that we have, aspiration prayers. And some of those are very famous, like Samantabhadra's aspiration prayer is very, very famous. And there's other ones too. So I think it's good to know that there's these different types of prayers, and that now I'm doing this, and now I'm doing that, and you have more of an understanding, well, why am I saying this? You know, what am I really doing here? Does that make sense? Yeah. Helps me anyway. So this is an aspiration by Master Nagarjuna. Okay, so we have gone through the process of refuge. We've done refuge, we've done the practice, we've done the dedication. Ready to get up off the cushion. The session is over, and we go on into our life. So then what happens? We'll find out on page 14. Who would like to read now?
I'll read it.
Okay.
In each interval between sessions, one should remember the excellent qualities of the three jewels and the mindful aspiration to follow them through not abandoning their recollection. One should refrain from acting contrary to the precepts of taking refuge. Since it was taught that all virtues are useless which are acquired by a person who lacks alertness and mindfulness, it is important always to maintain them. As it was said in the
That's Shantideva. Yeah, Shantideva.
Yeah. As if they had been snatched away by thieves, the merits one has gathered are lost by the thief of non-alertness who follows after impaired mindfulness, and so one goes to the lower states.
Okay, so some people think that Dharma practice only happens when you're sitting on a cushion. And of course that's not true. The interval between the cushion times is actually usually bigger than the cushion times. So this is telling us now what do we need to do in that interval. Okay, so we need to remember the excellent quality of the three jewels and the mindful aspiration. There's your aspiration. The mindful aspiration to follow them. How? Through not abandoning their recollection. So that's your cup with the crack in it. You don't want to have a cup with a crack. You want to remember. So don't abandon the recollection. And then how do you act? Well, you should refrain from acting contrary to the precepts of taking refuge. So we'll talk more about that later specifically, but it's basically don't misbehave. Don't do bad stuff.
Paying attention to your body, speech, and mind.
Yeah. And then it says, since it was taught that all these virtues are useless, which are acquired by a person who lacks alertness and mindfulness, it's important always to maintain them. So here we are again. Shantideva again is reminding us, got to be present when you're doing it. If you're spacing out, it doesn't count. Keep your mind focused on the practice. But also keep your mind focused in the interval time. Because that's when it's really easy to get distracted, right? So he's reminding us, you know. In fact, in one of his texts, he says, you should guard your mind as if you were guarding a wound walking through a crowd. So believe me, when I walk in crowds, I guard my wounds because actually your mind is more important than your wound. So really be mindful and aware and alert. He says here in the text, it's important always to maintain them. And then the quotation from Shantideva about merit being snatched away like, you know, thieves stealing your non-alertness. So if you don't maintain alertness, then there's the risk of doing non-virtue and then bad karma and then lower rebirth and so on. You don't want that, of course. So he's just reminding us again to be mindful. And if that wasn't enough, he's going to remind us again in the next quotation, anyone who wishes to maintain the training that has been undertaken should diligently guard one's mind. And again, Shantideva advises, quote, a person who wishes to guard the discipline should guard his mind with great care, for if the mind be unprotected, he also cannot protect the training. So we're going through this training. We're learning how to be a bodhisattva, become enlightened. Obviously, we didn't know exactly how to do it or we'd be enlightened already. So we need to be trained. But if you don't guard your mind, you're not going to guard the training. So the mind, as usual, is the thing to focus on. So that's what we do when we get off of the cushion and we go out into life and we have our interval. And then when we go back to the cushion for whatever practice we're going to do, then we do the three-step practice that we've been taught how to do it. So that's how to do refuge. It's kind of a elaborate version, a little bit longer. We have shorter versions that we do sometimes. But the point is still the same, that it's something that we need to do continuously and be aware of and maintain our awareness that refuge is really, it's what defines being, it's how you define being a Buddhist. If you If you haven't taken refuge, you're not a Buddhist. So, Sakyapandita's clarifying the sage's intent lays this out in great detail that before a person becomes a Buddhist, if you have positive tendencies and proclivities, if you're naturally compassionate and so on, you'd be attracted to spiritual practice. But you're not really a Buddhist. You haven't really stepped on the path until you've taken refuge. That's kind of the doorway into becoming Buddhist. And then you're saying, okay, these are going to be my teachers, and this is the path I'm going to do. And then once you step on that path, it's not a one-time thing. We do it over and over and over again to strengthen our path and our practice. So refuge, when does it end? For a Mahayana person, it doesn't end until you're enlightened. You keep going, you keep doing the practices until you're enlightened. So we say that, we go for refuge until enlightenment. So that section tells you how to do it. And now we're going to go to why do we do it? What's the benefit of doing? So this is section D, the benefit of taking refuge. Do we have a reader?
I can read.
Okay.
The benefits of taking the refuge are said to be limitless, such as being the cause which gives rise to all the vows, and so on. In a sutra, it is taught, if this merit of taking refuge and praying had a form, even the entire space would be too small to hold it. So, endowed with this special joy, one should reflect in the following way. In brief, in all the worlds of the gods and others, there is no other deity which is a refuge more excellent than that of the three jewels, and, starting from today, I have gained them as my protectors. Gaining them is the best of all gains.
Okay, thank you. So, this section is short because the benefit is so great. There is really not a whole lot to elaborate when you say, well, if it had a form, the entire universe wouldn't be able to contain it. I mean, maybe you've seen that new satellite they sent up that's taking all these incredible pictures. Universe is pretty big.
It's more than one.
So if that's not big enough to contain refuge, it's beyond normal comprehension, I would say. So it's really the best gain of all. It's better than winning the lottery. It's better than being the most powerful person in the world. It's better than traveling to Mars. It's just an unbelievable benefit. So the importance of it can't be overemphasized. Yeah. So the section is short, but the message is big. And then the final section, section E, we're on page 15 if you have a book. What are the precepts of taking refuge? So, who would like to read this first paragraph here?
I would like to, if nobody else does. If worldlings try to behave themselves in order to please their rulers and refrain from infringing upon any number of rules laid down by officials who merely help them to accomplish worldly aims, how much more so then should one never act against the precepts taught by the three jewels, who are the masters that help one to achieve incomparable awakening? One should certainly think in this way.
Okay, so that's pretty self-evident. You know, if people follow worldly rules for whatever reason, surely we are going to eventually attain incomparable awakening, that is perfect enlightenment. Well, we should follow the precepts. Okay, let's continue. Nicole, do you want to continue there?
Okay. Precepts, which are common to all three of the jewels, consist of injunctions that one should associate with holy persons and the like. The individual precepts for each of the three jewels are having taken a refuge in the enlightened ones, one should not pay homage to worldly deities. Having taken refuge in the teaching, One must give up all acts of harm and mischief towards other living beings. Having taken refuge in the assembly, one should not associate with heretical friends. Moreover, one should not forsake the jewels even for the sake of one's life, and certainly not for rewards. No matter what illness or pain may occur, one must not give up the three jewels. When rising and retiring, one should prostrate to a shrine of the three jewels. When eating, one should do in accordance with the words of Master Atisha.
Oh, yeah, okay, so let's just stop there for a second and go back through this a little bit. So there's what are called the common and the uncommon injunctions. Okay, so the common ones apply to all the objects of refuge, which is associate with holy persons and the like. And as we've said before, and that implies, and don't hang out with people that are going to lead you astray. So that's really important. That applies to all the refuge objects. And then each object has its individual precepts. So having taken refuge in the enlightened one, one should not pay homage to worldly deities. So maybe we should explain that a little bit. In the Buddhist pantheon, there are gods or deities which are sort of at, we would say, sort of at a higher level, but they're not fully enlightened beings. So an example of that would be Ganapati, if anybody's familiar with Ganapati, and there's other ones. There's actually lots of them. But there's a distinction made between an unenlightened being and an enlightened being. Now, in this case, this translation, I think, is slightly misleading because it says we should not pay homage to worldly deities. I think the way I would rephrase that is we should not go for refuge to worldly deities. Certainly in some cases like Ganapati, there is homage paid because Ganapati is a protector and he's helpful to us. So we do, for example, make offerings or pay homage, but we never go to refuge. There's a distinct line there. So what this is saying is, really is saying, don't go to refuge to worldly deities. And there's lots of them, so you can give lots of examples, but the point here is that you want to be clear that I'm not going for refuge to a worldly deity. I only go for refuge to an enlightened being. So that's a precept. Having taken refuge in the teaching, one must give up all acts of harm and mischief sort towards other living beings. Why? Because we're bodhisattvas. We've committed ourselves to helping other beings, so we certainly don't want to harm them. And then having taken refuge in the assembly or the sangha, one should not associate with heretical, is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah.
Friends. So, again, don't hang out with people that are going to lead you, you know, down the wrong path. And then, moreover, one should not forsake the jewels, even for the sake of one's life, and certainly not for rewards. Do you remember we talked about this before? About don't sell your soul to the devil, you know. Just don't give it up. Don't give it up for anything that's not worth it, you know. Even if it means your life. And no matter what illness or pain may occur, one must not give up the three jewels. So certainly illness and pain can be trying, but it's not a good reason to give up. You can't say, oh, well, they're not looking after me because I have this pain or I have this problem. That's really not the way to look at it. And then it says,
it's because it's not up to them around that stuff anyways, right?
This is a big topic, but you know, for things to happen or not happen, a lot of things have to come together, you know, in the right mixture, so to speak.
That's part of our practice.
Yeah.
Is taking responsibility for.
And then it says, when rising and retiring, one should prostrate to a shrine of the three jewels. The shrine, hopefully at home you have some kind of shrine or something, or at least a statue or an image. And even if you don't, you visualize it. So when you get up in the morning, you want to go for refuge because you're starting your day. You're setting the tone for your day. You're setting the objective for your day. I'm going to have a spiritual day. you know, before you go off into your busy life, which we all have, you want to set the tone by going for refuge. And then again, when you retire, before you go to bed, actually, I just asked Lama this question just before, just so that I had it clear. And there's different ways of looking at this, but one way of looking at it is at the end of the day, you want to do a review of how did your day go. You know, was I virtuous? Was I non-virtuous? Did I practice? Did I not? Did I slip up? Did I forget? Do a kind of a summary. And then if you slipped up, if you made a mistake, then you want to confess it. Say, okay, well, it's not really what I should have done. I'm sorry. And there's a whole confession teaching and ceremony, which we won't get into now. But basically, you want to regret what you did wrong that day. And, okay, tomorrow I'll do better. And so you want to do refuge in the morning. You can do refuge in the evening, but it should really include this sort of review confession process.
Do the Sakyas call it purification?
Purification, yeah. So you want to have a routine. You know, when you have a routine, okay, it's morning, first thing I'm going to go for refuge, it's the evening, go for refuge, do confession. You get into the routine, and then your practice doesn't depend on your mood, or how good you feel, or what happened to you today, or whatever. It's steady progress towards the goal. Okay, so that's the recommendation. Here.
It's kind of a review of our behavior throughout the day.
Yeah.
Body, speech, and mind.
And then this goes into a description about what to do when you eat. So who would like to read this section for us?
I'll read it.
Okay.
Divide the food into four shares. Offer the first part of pure sustenance to the deities, three jewels. Then to the protectors and guardians of the teaching, offer ceremonial cakes. Oneself should eat and drink and share, and the remains of that should be given to all spirits.
You can keep going.
In this manner, with the portion of food one has reserved for offering, offer a share to each of the preceptors, patron deities, the three jewels, guardians of the teaching, and wealth deities. To uphold the words of the Enlightened One, present some of Hariti and her children and to the spirits who have a right to receive offerings. As it was taught in the Bodhicaryata Bharatara, this human body is only meant for service.
Okay, so this is fairly elaborate food offering description here. You can also do it in a simpler form. But you shouldn't just sit down and start wolfing it down. you should, you know, try to remain spiritual before you dive in and make an offering. You know, it can be a physical offering of actually setting the food aside, but for sure you need to do it with your mind. Why? Because that makes a neutral act a virtuous act. Most of our day is neutral activities. You know, it's neither good nor bad, but we can convert neutral activities into spiritual activities by setting our motivation. So this is a way, a description of turning eating, something that most of us do several times a day, into an actual spiritual practice. And there's other ways of doing it. There's this reference to, I believe it's Hariti, I'm not sure the pronunciation, and her children. This is a story. Does anybody know this story? No. This is from the sutras, okay? It's a fairly well-known story, and she's described as a demoness, but, and I guess she was, but I really feel sorry for her, whatever being she was. This was a female who had, I guess you would call it a compulsion. And during the day, she was just a really wonderful mother. And at night, she sort of turned into this sort of awful being, sort of Dr. Heckle and Mr. Jide, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of thing. And she would, I hate to say it, but she would go and eat children. And she was really upset about this behavior that she had that she couldn't control. She really didn't know what to do with it. So she went to the Buddha and said, please help me. You know, I've got this problem and I would really like to get rid of it. Will you help me? And so the Buddha, of course, listened with compassion and promised her that he would instruct his Sangha to, every time they had a meal, to set aside a food offering for her, specifically to alleviate this sort of compulsion that she had of
eating children.
And so that is, to this day, as far as I know, it's still a practice. It's something that was supplicated. She asked, she went and asked, and he said yes and responded.
So is this like metaphorical? Like, what does she represent in each one of us, and what do the children represent within the world?
What do you think?
I mean, children always represent being like, not naive, but like innocent. And so so what would she represent? Like desire? But like, I don't understand. I don't know. That's why I'm asking the question.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else have an idea?
No, well, that kind of makes sense to me, that she has a terrible afflictive mind, and that preys on the innocence of the world, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to what Nicole said.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else have an idea? Personally, I think this is an actual story, an actual true story. And I think, like a lot of stories, it also has other levels that we can look at and apply, and mainly apply to ourselves. So we would look from our own point of view, well, how might this apply to me? Do I have any obsessions that lead me to non-virtue? Do I have any compulsions that take me down the wrong road? Do I need to ask for help? Do I need to supplicate the Buddha's assistance, you know, to stay on the path better? I don't think there's one answer to what does it represent. I think, this is my opinion,
right.
I think it can be varied for each of us, you know. That's where you want to look inward and see, well, where is my lesson here, you know.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's helpful for me to think of it as a real story and something that really happened, because one might say that eating a child would be one of the, well, worst things you could do, but even someone who did this was deserving of compassion,
yeah.
Deserving of the patience. And so if I really believe that she really did that and she was still deserving of compassion, then I think that's helpful for me in the way I think.
Yeah. Thank you.
The worst of the worst.
That's great compassion.
Yeah.
Even for the people you don't like.
Yeah. Well, and I give her credit for recognizing and going and asking for help. I mean, mm-hmm. We all have our areas.
She has her own children. I mean, I'm sure there was the fear that she might eat her own children.
She never ate her own children?
That fear may have been there that she had.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I mean, who wants to go through life like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the story says she was terrorizing the village, is what it says. So, anyway.
So she had no friends, people were afraid of her, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so so Shanti Deva says, this human body is only meant for service. What do you think that means?
It's basically our vehicle that we use in this life to, where our body, mind, and speech is expressed through this vehicle from our mind.
Yeah. So for a Mahayana person, your body isn't just your body, but it's a vehicle of service for all sentient beings. It's the actual vehicle that we have now. Okay, so we're going to continue a little bit more about eating here. Does somebody want to read this next part?
I'll continue.
Okay.
Eating should be moderated by reflecting.
I nourish this body with food that is in harmony with the teachings in order to employ it in virtuous acts. Whatever remainder of food there may be should then be dedicated to the remaining spirits who have the right to receive it. Bodhicarya Vatara advises, food should be divided amongst those who are destitute, those who are protectorless, and those meditators engaged in the practice of austerities.
Okay, so this is just a continuation of the idea that eating and offering food can be turned into a spiritual practice. We should also remember that there are poor people who need a meal, and that if we can, we can certainly help them. But also there's a line here that says, so the food should be divided among these different groups, the destitute, but also meditators engage in the practice of austerities. What do you think that means?
Those ones who've gone off to the mountains to devote themselves to cleaning up their minds.
Okay, so that's one possibility, make offerings to a retreatant.
Right.
Okay, what's another possibility?
Wasn't there another practice of touching money or not handling money for some people?
Yeah, and how does that relate to this?
They might need food from people if they can't buy it.
Yeah, okay, so that's along the same lines to support practitioners. There's another meaning, though.
To what word?
Hmm?
To what?
We want to give food to meditators engaged in the practice of austerity. What if I said extreme austerity? What's the Buddha's story? Does anybody remember the stages that the Buddha went through? He was born a prince, he had it made. Oh, yeah. And then what happened?
Well, and then he started going down the road of the yogis, and where it was thought that if you deprived yourself to the extreme that you would gain enlightenment through that, which of course he found out wasn't correct. So I guess it's to help them understand that or
yeah.
See that for themselves.
Yeah, so the Buddha actually showed that way is not the path, to just to not eat anything and get really skinny and deprive yourself, and that's not the way to do it. And he eventually, as you said, he eventually renounced that, and there's stories in the sutras about this, and then he avoided that extreme. So the first extreme was when he was in the palace as the prince, he had everything and more. But that wasn't the path, so he left that. And then he went to the other extreme of extreme austerities and did that for 6 years. And you might even see statues sometimes of the Buddha where he's just like literally practically a skeleton. Have anybody ever seen the Buddha? I don't know if we have any.
Yeah,
Dalai
Lama actually has one in his...
Emaciated, like really, really emaciated. And then he went, well, that's not the way to do it. So he went from this extreme to that extreme, and then he went to the middle. And voila, what do we call the Mahayana path? But the middle way, right? So we're not extremists in either of those directions. And so this refers also to practitioners who've maybe gotten bad instructions and they've gone to that extreme.
But could you also think of it in a way that he realized that self-compassion is an important part of
mm-hmm.
to have compassion for oneself and
mm-hmm.
not to abuse oneself in that way?
Yeah, because as we just said, our body is our vehicle. So if you starve yourself to death, what good is that?
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. So that's a kind of hidden meaning here. And we're just getting to the end of this chapter, so let's just keep reading here. Who would like to continue?
I'll take over.
Yeah.
In this way, one should actually give poor, the unprotected, and the practitioners, thinking, may this virtue become the cause of benefit and happiness for beings now and permanently. even with such small precepts, one should train oneself into acting accordingly to the instructions on the dedication of merit. Prayers for one's own and others' benefit, and the like. In every activity, whether great or small, one should perform it by relying upon the three jewels.
Okay, and you can continue.
Okay. Never think, even though I have confidence in the three jewels, it is not really certain that this will work. That this work will be accomplished. Instead, one should know that the enlightened one is surely able to protect those who surrender and act in accord with his words, because the enlightened one is endowed with the transcendental wisdom, which knows all the paths of practice that are in harmony with intelligence and nature of all living beings. Because he has the compassionate desire to establish his disciples on the right path after turning them from wrong ways, and because he has accomplished the two accumulations of merit and transcendental wisdom, and has accomplished the resolve to help beings. So even though one has not yet attained liberation from worldly existence, it is one's fault for not having trusted and not having acted in accordance with the words of the three jewels, not because the three jewels had no compassion. Therefore, as the...
Yeah, Abhisamaya Alankara, that's a text by Maitreya, we talked about before.
Just as spoiled seeds do not sprout even though the King of Gods may make rain, so the unfortunate may not experience wholesomeness although the enlightened one has come.
Okay, so that's pretty self-evident. But there is one thing here where it says, so even though one has not yet attained liberation from worldly existence, it is one's fault for not having trusted and not having acted in accord with the words of the three jewels. Not because the three jewels have no compassion. So we've made reference to this already before. Geshe Taji Namgyal said, Buddha lived 2,600 years ago. How come you're not enlightened yet? You know, it's not the Buddha's fault. It's not the Buddha lacked compassion. We just haven't gotten there by doing the work and the practice yet. So it's really important not to blame anybody else, but to take responsibility and say, okay, I'm not going to make an excuse here and, you know, blame the Buddha. You know, well, he didn't teach well enough, or he didn't, I don't know, whatever. It's, you know, I need to sit down and do the work. And so it's really important to have that kind of clarity of mind that it's not the Buddha lacking compassion that's the cause of me not being enlightened yet, okay? And Maitreya says that, just as spoiled seeds do not sprout, even though the King of Gods, which is Indra, by the way, may make rain, so the unfortunate may not experience wholesomeness, although the enlightened one has come. And then we're almost at the end of the chapter here, and Shantideva says, if from today I make no effort, I shall sink lower and lower. Though countless Buddhas have passed by who are the benefactors of all living beings, I did not come within the range of their salvation because of my own flaws. In other words, I didn't have enough good karma to actually be there with the Buddha 2,600 years ago. And it's just another way of saying the same thing, that I need to sort of get it together now and really take responsibility and start practicing and not make any excuses about anybody or anything else. So, in brief, those who do not entrust themselves to the precious jewels, who are arrogant and who assume they are intelligent, have no certainty in accomplishing their schemes. Even if they are accomplished, it is not certain whether those schemes will turn out well in the long run. So it's important to entrust oneself always to the three jewels. So that's just kind of a summary saying, even if you think you can do it, refuge is good. Refuge is a good, trustworthy, time-tested, you know, path that's been shown. Many, 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 many people have become enlightened following this path, and it's good to follow it. So that's the end of the preliminaries. Anybody have comments or questions or complaints?
So, when we get in trouble, we all go somewhere. And that's our refuge. And some people go to one thing and some people go to another. So it's really, there is an ideal refuge. Which is
our, there is or there isn't?
There is. And it's our nature.
Yeah.
It's our nature. So it's ideal. And we're going to do something anyway. We're going to go somewhere anyway. Might as well go to the ideal.
Words of wisdom.
And I've heard it said another way is to bring it into the Dharma. Whatever troubles or challenges you're experiencing is to bring it into the Dharma.
What does that mean, bring it into the Dharma?
To bring it as part of your practice, learn from it.
Uh-huh.
Use it as a teaching.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Which is what the three jewels represent. Right?
Uh-huh. Okay. Anybody else have something they want to add? Okay, so we've made it through the preliminaries, and next time we'll start with the actual practices. So check your cups this week. See if they're full or leaking or whatever. And as always, we'll end with a dedication. So nam de tam che zi pan tom nam e pe da nam pam je de ke ga na ji ba lung tu pe yi si pe so le du e du ar sho jang chu sem cho grim po che Ma ke pa nam ke gur che ke ma nam par ve par yam gong ne gong tu pe par sho jam pa pa o ji tar ken pa tong gong tu song bo de yang de jin de de da kung ye je su da Ge wa di dag nam che rab tu mu Tu su shek pi gya wa tam che ki Nya wa gang la chu tuk nam pa gi Dag shen ge wa se wa di kun ka Sang po chu che rab tu nu war gi Chak sa wa da chu ching sha pa da Jizu yi rung gu shing so wa yi Ge wa chung se da gi chi sa pa Tam jizu pe jang chu chi By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen, but never decline where it has arisen, but may it overgrow and flourish. By whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I may train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise the Supreme, victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.